I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Sometimes the words we use reveal something important about the human condition. Think about being told to trust your gut feeling, or being gut-checked, or gutsy, or gutless. Researchers are exploring the powerful connection between our gut and our mental and physical health. Our bodies are home to trillions of bacteria, fungi, and other chemicals that make up our microbiome. It looks like this ecosystem plays an important role regulating a number of physiological processes. So today on Radio Times, know your gut. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Gary Wu is the Ferdinand G. Weisbrod Professor of Gastroenterology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, also co-director of the PennCHOP Microbiome Program. And Gary Wu, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Frederick Bushman, and he is the W.M. Meese Professor and Chair of the Microbiology Department at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, also the co-principal investigator of the PennCHOP Microbiome Program. And Rick Bushman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
And our third guest is Tracy Bale. She's professor of neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine and in psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine, and also co-director of the Center for the Study of Sex and Gender in Behavioral Health. And Tracy Bale, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Clearly, Penn is in on this microbiome. Let me begin with you, if I could, Gary Wu, and just to make sure that our listeners are basically on the same table here, on the same wavelength here. When we talk about the microbiome, what are we talking about?
So the microbiota is collectively all the microorganisms that live on our bodies or within our bodies. And so it's commonly thought of as primarily bacteria, but it's actually important to know that there are other types of microbes that live in our environment, fungi, viruses. And another form of life called archaea that most people don't know about. It's a third domain of life. And that particular organism sort of looks like bacteria, but it actually has different functions.
And so we're talking about inside the body, in the gut, I guess the intestines, and also on our skin.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Our entire environment is filled with these organisms. And they're on our body surface. We inhale them. They're in our intestinal tract. We basically live in a very mutualistic relationship with our environment that contains all of these microbes.
And Rick, what does this do for us? Talk about a basic question here.
Well, the microbiome, the bugs of your microbiome encode all kinds of functions that your body doesn't encode. For example, the bugs in your stomach encode machinery for digesting certain foods that we couldn't digest if they weren't there. They help our immune system grow. They metabolize drugs when we take them and change the rate at which we clear those drugs. Having a healthy collection of microbes in your gut and on your skin repels invaders and so helps prevent colonization by pathogens. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Is this a relatively, Tracy, is this a sort of a relatively new area of investigation?
If you're a microbiologist, no.
No.
But as a neuroscientist, yes. This is something that within the field of understanding the function and importance for both the developing brain as well as the adult and aging brain as well, the interaction, as Rick just pointed out, the many facets of which the microbiome in your gut and elsewhere is so essential for how we process metabolites in our foods, how we interact with the immune system. You could imagine many different ways in which it can impact the function of your brain.
I'm thinking, Gary, about all the antimicrobials. I mean, all the antibacteria soaps and things that you can put on your counter. Are we in a sense hurting our microbiome by trying to be so clean in so much of our life?
Yes, there is a concern, and broadly speaking, there's a hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis, where things are becoming much more sterilized, and we do worry that some of the increasing incidence of certain types of inflammatory disease processes like allergies are being driven by an alteration in the microbial world. And one of the larger offenders is the use of these antibiotics or maybe excessive cleanliness per se. And so we do know that individuals living in more rural areas and farms have a lower prevalence of asthma than people living in more urbanized centers that are sort of living in a more sterilized environment.
Should we eat dirt, so to speak?
Well, I've
sort of introduce more dirty kinds of things into our environment.
I've often heard that you should let your kids play in that sandbox, you know, and you don't necessarily have to scrub your hands all the time with antibacterial soap. There is increasing evidence that maybe that is somehow doing some harm. The other thing is that not only the stuff on your body, but just your environment. The use of antibiotics is changing our access to different types of microbes in the environment.
In fact, Rick, I was even reading things like sanitation, refrigeration, and food processing, that all of this, which we think of as a positive thing, might be having an effect on our microbiome.
Yeah, it may well be that we're experiencing less diverse microbes or different microbes as a result of life in the modern world. And you can see that in some of the microbiome data. People have studied gut bacteria in urban dwellers and people who live in remote societies living traditional lifestyles, and they see different patterns in what
really?
Kinds of bugs are there. That's basically a result at this point.
I mean, sort of what Gary Wu was saying earlier about just sort of different, and if we're talking about gut bacteria, we're talking about fecal matter, are we not?
That's a pretty easy kind of specimen to get. So very commonly, that's what's studied. Although, to be careful, people often as well can study other kinds of samples, like from the wall of the gut. If you're studying bowel inflammation, for example, often you want to study something that's closer to what exactly you want to know about. So there's lots of different kinds of samples that are studied in the field, but poop is
for lack
common.
Of it, right. That's the scientific term. Tracy, you've done some interesting research involving mice. Take us through that and what you know so far.
So taking a step back in time during development, you know, what Gary and Rick have been talking about is the current state of your gut and the microbes' importance, but how those microbes got there in the first place is actually very interesting to think about in terms of the birth process. So as you pass through the birth canal, you ingest the mom's vaginal microbiome, and that initial inoculant is what's so important for establishing many aspects that will follow you throughout life. So the interaction of those initial microbes helps set up niches within your gut, and those niches also interact and teach and educate your immune system. They interact with your enteric nervous system. So all of this happens during those initial neonatal weeks, and it's very important then that you receive this healthy vaginal microbiota from birth. So in mice, we actually were interested in if mom was stressed during her pregnancy, if that would change the composition. And again, you're looking for sort of the diversity of that microbiota. And we found that it did, that mom experiencing stress during her pregnancy changed her composition of her microbiota, and that when those babies then passed through the birth canal, their inoculant was different than a non-stressed mom's, and it set up and established a very specific microbiota within their gut, changed both the permeability of their gut's interaction with their immune system, et cetera. And ultimately, as neuroscientists, we're interested in this association then between maternal stress and neurodevelopment.
So where do we take – I mean, I realize this is, I guess, the beginning kind of research, but where do you go from there?
There's a million different directions to go. And one of the aspects that really points to the importance of this healthy vaginal microbiota at birth is that babies born by C-section have a much higher incidence of allergies throughout life, which again speaks to this idea that if you don't receive that initial inoculant, then you're more likely to have your gut microbiome be seeded by maybe aspects within the hospital environment, which we know not to be healthy, or maybe just divergent because of mom's skin exposure versus the birth canal.
I mean, if let's say someone has a C-section and if they're listening to this thinking, uh-oh, am I putting my baby at risk, is there a way to offset some of that?
Well, this is a great question. This is where the current state of clinical trials and research is right now and actually asking this question. So there are trials within the United States, Canada, and Europe that are actually asking that question. So if we take C-section babies and actually orally expose them to mom's vaginal and skin microbiota, does that then lead to a longer and greater health resilience than you would find and if you didn't expose them?
I was reading again and doing some homework for today's show, Gary Wu, that the body is gut-centric. That was one of the phrases that I ran across. I wrote it down because I didn't totally understand it, but can you flesh that out for us?
Well, you know, as a gastroenterologist, I have to admit I completely agree with
I
that.
I figured you did.
But nephrologists
would tell us why.
Yeah, the nephrologist would say the kidney is the most important. I think the gut is, amongst many organs, very important because most of the lymphocytes, most of the immune cells are actually in your gut. So about 80% of all your immune cells are actually in your intestinal tract, which actually means the maturation of your response to your environment in terms of your immune system. And that's relevant to allergies and many different types of immune-mediated processes. These are primarily educated in the gut. Now, there are other sites in the body, in the lung and even on the skin, but the gut is the primary source for education of our immune system that, again, is interacting with our microbial environment internally that may be predisposing to development of various types of diseases.
Well, taking this baby born by C-section, is there something a mother can do to increase the microbiota?
Yeah, so there are some ongoing studies in Peru and other places where they're actually using a vaginal sponge in babies that are being delivered by C-section and actually swabbing the mouth and the skin surface to try to initiate that initial vaginal inoculum in a baby that otherwise wouldn't be exposed to it. I do think, however, it's very important to keep in mind that microbiome research is actually at a very early stage right now. There are a lot of things that we don't understand. And C-sections are being used appropriately in certain medical conditions. So it's actually very important that people, I think, understand that what doctors recommend, if you need a C-section, get the C-section done. Listen to your physician. Don't worry that much about the microbiome because we actually don't know how much of an effect it is. As Tracy said, there are association studies saying that if you're born by C-section, maybe you're at higher risk for a development of allergies. But that doesn't mean that your child born by C-section is going to be developing a lot of allergies.
About a minute or so before our first break here, I'm back to you, Rick. So what specifically are you looking at?
Well, I'm in the PenChop microbiome program. I'm kind of the techno nerd guy. We do a lot of methods development, deep sequencing, bioinformatics. Much of what's launched the field has been the technological developments that's given rise to the popularity of the microbiome in recent years. As Tracy said, it goes back a long time. In 1851, famous Penn researcher Joseph Leidy wrote a book called On the Flora and Fauna Associated with Animals. So the idea has been around a long time. But what's changed is our ability to measure it. So you can take a sample of saliva or poop or whatever, purify DNA, and determine sequence of that bulk DNA specimen. And then the databases are well developed. So you can take the DNA sequences that you recover, align them to databases and say, aha, that's an E. coli or that's a Bacillus subtilis or whatever it is. And so read out the kinds and numbers of bacteria that are there using DNA sequence information. And that is absolutely amazing. We just submitted a paper where we determined, and I'm not making this up, over half a trillion bases of sequence information.
Half a trillion.
Yeah.
Well, hold on to that thought only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about our microbiome with Gary Wu, Tracy Bale, and Rick Bushman. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowane. We're talking about how our microbes impact our well-being. And again, our guests are Rick Bushman. He's the chair of the microbiology department at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Tracy Bale, professor of neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. And Gary Wu is a professor in gastroenterology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and co-director of the PennChop Microbiome Program. Let me open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Gary, let me just ask you what I asked you off the air, which is is everyone's microbiome unique to them?
Yes, and in fact, everybody tends to be somewhat different from each other. In fact, it's one of the largest sources of what we call variance or difference between individuals, which actually means studying humans is somewhat challenging because when we look at effects of diet, for example, The differences between each other are somewhat greater than effects that we would traditionally think would be quite strong, for example, in diet.
And Rick, you were talking about this connection, again, off the air, between a mother and baby when it comes to microbiota.
Yeah, the data is coming in suggesting that there's an association between mother's milk and bacteria we can detect in baby's guts. So one possible explanation, what we think is probably most likely, is that mother's breast milk is seeding baby's gut and that she's delivering bacteria along with other stuff to baby, and that's helping structure the baby's microbiome.
And Tracy, sort of picking up on what you were talking about, what happens when a mother gives, and I guess in this case we're talking about mice here, but nonetheless, when a mother gives birth vaginally, the kinds of...
Right. So if you actually look at the sequence between mom's vaginal microbiota and the neonate's gut microbiota 24 hours after birth, there's a one-to-one relationship. So it's a direct match to what they in passing through the birth canal. But if you actually compare mom's gut to baby gut, they're completely divergent. So it's not just a sort of a genetic predisposition. It actually is a direct inoculation from birth.
Gary, is there a diet people can have that creates a healthy microbiome? Are we that far along?
In general, what people tend to find are the microbiota is richer. That is, the greater number of different types of organisms as well as their genes. In individuals that don't have the types of diseases we see in industrialized nations like diabetes and obesity, metabolic syndrome. And that basically tracks along with eating a lot of plant products and vegetables.
Really?
So people living in agrarian societies have a richer microbiota and have decreased prevalence of certain diseases that we see in industrialized nations. But it's very important to recognize that these are just associations. They don't prove cause and effect. So just because your microbiota is more diverse and looks healthier doesn't actually mean that that's making you healthier. And that's like the next level of research. We need to make these causative associations that we don't quite understand yet.
Rick, how would we know if our microbiota was healthy or not? I mean, we as an individual, are there outward signs we can look for?
Well, it's a complicated research question. Sometimes it's pretty clear cut. You can have bacteria that encode a recognizable nasty toxin gene, and that's definitely bad. Or you can have known pathogens, maybe with antibiotic resistance genes, and that's clearly bad. But there's far more subtle differences among healthy people or relatively healthy people, and what's good, what's bad. We're just launching into the sort of functional studies, careful tests of specific communities that would allow us to get to some of these more subtle kinds of answers.
Well, since we're on the radio and we're talking about microbiota and our gut, I mean, for instance, if someone has a lot of flatulence, is that a sign that there's something going on with their microbiome or their microbiota?
It might be, yeah.
It might be. I wanted more than that.
Well, there are certain bugs that are directly responsible for producing that gas. So, that could be definitely a product of your microbes. It might not be the only possibility.
Right.
But.
So I can add in here, because I'm a gastroenterologist and I see a lot of patients that complain of flatulence and gas and bloating. And, you know, gas in the bowel comes from primarily two sources. Either you're swallowing it yourself or the microbes are producing it, like hydrogen and methane. So it's very clear that certain individuals can have excess gas production. For example, if you have intestinal bacterial overgrowth in your small intestine,
right,
you're producing more hydrogen, more gas, you're bloated, you feel uncomfortable.
Do you want to add to that, Tracy?
So I think that in terms of how that feeds forward then to brain health as well as how you feel, I think that seems, you know, an obvious target. If you're bloated and or producing or not metabolizing nutrients in the way that you need for mental health as well, yeah, our interactions, as Rick pointed out, with your immune system, your host immunity. Because again, it's so important to think of this as not just what you eat gets to take up the bacteria, take up residence, that it's an interaction between the host, you, and the bacteria that are ingested or otherwise occupy that space. And even in rodent studies, we see this really interesting early developmental programming of what the gut, then the cells within the gut decide what gets to live there. So it's a constant communication between the host and the bacteria.
And is the goal, I mean, diversity, to have a kind of diversity of the biome?
I mean, that's typically was thought to be more healthy, right? So you get this diversity, as you said, if you live in an agrarian society, if you eat lots of raw vegetables, you're going to be exposed to more of that than if you cook everything, that diversity tends to, the complexity of it suggests a healthier gut.
We have an email from Laura, says, I was a super clean mom when my kids were babies, and both my kids, ages 8 and 11, have allergies now. Is it too late for them, or if I ease up on the cleaning now, will it help them? And I guess I'm back to you, Gary, which is there a cause and effect here, or just association, as you mentioned earlier?
I think in animal models, there's a pretty clear cause and effect relationship that certain types of microbes leading to certain types of immune responses are causative for the development of allergies. In humans, we have these association studies that say that, well, perhaps there might be that association. We just haven't proven it yet. I think the challenge is to understand how much of an effect actually is there.
Right.
The development of allergies may actually be imprinted actually very early on in life that maybe predispose you later on to development of these allergies. Whether or not it's ultimately reversible, I mean, I think that's what desensitization shots are for that allergists use. I mean, there are different types of approaches we use to try to decrease that allergen exposure, as well as getting these shots for desensitization. We already have methods to do that, to try to improve the state of somebody's quality of life who already have allergies. Whether or not that could be microbiota-based, mm-hmm. we don't really know that right now.
But you're saying whatever it is, it probably happens in utero? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not in utero. No. A lot of us think that it happens early on in life after you're born. So infants are born largely sterile, maybe not completely sterile, but a lot of us believe that very early on in life, that initial inoculum for the first couple of months, let's say, might be actually very important, because that's when your mucosal immune system is actually maturing.
You're nodding your head, Tracy.
Yeah, for sure. Both the mucosal immune system, as well as just the interaction again with what microbiota you're seeing. If you're in a really clean sort of postnatal environment, the education of your immune system may be somewhat diminished compared to somebody who's in a slightly less clean, not that we're advocating.
Is that an argument for desanitizing our environments, though?
I think that there's been an argument going on in the pediatric world for some time that the increase in allergies, peanut allergies, et cetera, is from an overly clean and sterile environment. Wow. And whether we need to pop the dirty binky back in the mouth, perhaps.
Oh, and as opposed to doing
sanitizing it again.
Gotcha. Rick?
There was a paper that came out just in the last week or so that's been getting a lot of press on asthma. And there, what they did, it was a Canadian study where they tracked a bunch of kids from birth, and some of them got asthma, some of them didn't. And what they thought they associated with asthma was transiently having the wrong bugs in their gut, the dysbiosis, as it's sometimes nicknamed in the field. And so it was an absence of some bugs that seemed to be favorable. And then these workers grew those bugs up, put them in a mouse model of asthma, and showed they could mitigate it. So here, in that case, it wasn't cleanliness or non-cleanliness. It was having the wrong bugs transiently in your gut early in life that mattered. And
how do you control for something like that, or can you?
I'm not sure.
it's sort of back to, understanding mental health and that your genetics by your environment, by developmental windows. I mean, it's a very complex sort of association. Mm-hmm.
Gary? So I can give you a really concrete example of healthcare policy that's important with the microbiome, but also potentially the development of allergies and other types of diseases, and that's the overuse of antibiotics, particularly in the young. So there are many reasons why we are concerned about the overuse of antibiotics. It's because it leads to antibiotic-resistant organisms. It can predispose to certain types of diseases. And now we have this notion that maybe it alters or disrupts that normal relationship we have with our microbiota. So there are many reasons why overuse of antibiotics may be causing some harm. Now, having said that, antibiotics have probably saved more lives than almost any other intervention except for maybe vaccines. But they should be used appropriately.
Yeah.
And so use of antibiotics with people with viral syndromes where antibiotics will not be of any use is probably harming the microbial environment, needlessly. And as a physician, it's very hard because a lot of people ask for antibiotics, and you have to sometimes toe the line and say no because I don't think it's appropriate in a certain circumstance.
And Tracy, that's sort of early, I mean, those in first, what, 6 months of life, that kind of thing?
So studies in rodents models as well as humans have definitively shown that there's higher risk for everything from obesity by antibiotic exposures to other allergies, et cetera, because of the specificity and diminishing the diversity of the gut microbiota.
You've mentioned the word mental health a couple of times. We've been focusing largely on physical health or the body, but you're saying there's some other connections.
Right, they go hand in hand. Your gut produces a huge number of, besides interaction with your immune system and the potential for that to impact the brain, but also neurotransmitters, there's feedback, direct vagal neuronal feedback to the brain to sort of say the status of what's going on in the gut, right, as well as your enteric nervous system, which has lots of neurotransmitters and involvement there. Tons of serotonin is produced during early development, and that helps establish many aspects of the developing brain. So it's very important, again, for this diversity during that period.
And Rick, sort of really cementing that the body-brain connection to the microbiome?
Yeah, it's a topic of intense interest. There's some amazing studies in like invertebrates and mice where the idea is that specific bugs program very specific behaviors, like the zombie ants. It's absolutely
what
unbelievable.
Do they do?
The idea is ants run around on the forest floor. They get infected by this fungus, and the allegation is the fungus causes the ant to climb up to a certain height on a tree, clamp down, and die. And that's the perfect position, perfect humidity for the fungus to germinate and spread its spores. So the idea is that the fungus is taking over the ant and directing its behavior. And there are other examples. It's been suggested that toxoplasmosis, which can infect mice, maybe causes them to act in a way that promotes getting caught by cats. And that's good for toxo because it grows to high titers inside cats and is widely dispersed as a result. So, you know, how much of what our microbes are doing in there is making chemicals that are affecting our thinking, our behavior? It's a totally open question.
It's very easy for fungus or parasites, especially once they enter the brain, but even from the gut itself, to change metabolites or immune responses, or once the toxo parasite gets in the brain, has a huge impact on neurotransmitter function and can completely change the rodent's behavior, which is brilliant for the parasite to allow that rodent to be then captured and consumed by a cat.
We've been focusing on things like asthma, but I'm wondering about colitis and irritable bowel syndrome, maybe even Crohn's disease. Are these, from what we know, Gary, are they part of this microbiome and our understanding of how this works?
Yeah, so for inflammatory bowel disease, which afflict about 1.5 million people in the United States alone, millions of people around the world, it's very clear that the pathogenesis development of inflammatory bowel disease involves not only genetics, our genetics of the host, so our genes predispose us to development of inflammatory bowel disease. But we know their microbial environment is absolutely essential for the development of inflammatory bowel disease. And we do believe that the incidence of inflammatory bowel disease is increasing very rapidly in many places around the world. Began in the United States and other industrialized nations several decades ago. And now we've seen a very rapid increase in Japan, which the Japanese are pretty much like the people in Europe and the United States and in Israel. And now we're beginning to see this in China.
Really?
Which is rapidly increasing, and it's really disturbing to the Chinese because of the very large number of patients that are there. And the question is there something that we can do in our environment to decrease that risk? That really rapid increase over the past several decades cannot be a genetic effect on us because our genomes don't evolve that rapidly. It's a very strong environmental effect. And we think that because microbes are so important in the pathogenesis development of inflammatory bowel disease, it has something to do with our microbial environment. And I think the race is on to try to discover what those factors are to try to not only treat disease, and we can talk about that, but actually try to prevent disease, which is really the gold marker that we're trying to get to.
Do you want to add to that, Rick, as someone who does research in this field?
Well, with Gary and colleague Jim Lewis at Penn, we've been carrying out a detailed study of microbes in the gut. In one study, we recruited about 80 kids just starting therapy and studied their gut bugs as they went on to therapy that either was or wasn't successful. And we saw a whole bunch of stuff. There's a lot of fungi in the worst affected kids, so that brings in that part of the microbiome. Maybe there's a fungal piece. We saw very strong effects of antibiotics, which are often used as a therapy for the for these kids and are used heavily generally. And so some of our most dysbiotic microbiota was associated with kids who had inflammatory bowel disease and were also taking antibiotics as well, which makes you wonder how much it's helping, how much it's hurting. Should we do something to mitigate the effects of antibiotics on the microbiome as well? So we can definitely, we and many others have measured changes in the microbiome associated with inflammatory bowel disease. And so now we're digging hard to try to understand what's cause, what's effect, and what can we do to intervene and make it better.
We're almost up on our second break here. Tracy, and I see a number of comments on our Facebook page and our email about yogurt. I mean, if you eat yogurt, then can you mitigate some of the potential problems here? Yes, no?
Yeah, I think there's enough evidence that suggests that the probiotic or beneficial aspect of the microbiota present in yogurt can be somewhat beneficial. But again, you're dealing with the impact of what you're ingesting and what your gut is going to allow to take up residence and how the complexity of your gut. It's not just as simple as you ingested microbe A and it allowed to take up residence and flourish. So it's not quite that simple, but I think in given individuals, you know, it certainly there is some evidence that it can be helpful.
And nothing wrong with eating plain yogurt anyway, right?
Right.
You just made a funny face.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see a bunch of people want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about our microbiome. We're just beginning to understand the critical role that the trillions of bacteria, fungi, and other chemicals play in our health. Talking with Gary Wu and Tracy Bale and Rick Bushman. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Keep those comments coming. Radio Time at WHYY.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me quickly reintroduce our guests. Tracy Bale is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine and in psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine. Gary Wu, professor of gastroenterology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and co-director of the Penn CHOP Microbiome Program. And Rick Bushman is a chair, actually, of the Department of Microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, co-principal investigator of the Penn CHOP Microbiome Program. And we are talking about our microbiome. We got a lot of calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, do you want to weigh in on yogurt and probiotics and all of that?
Well, I think the good news is they're probably not going to hurt you, but I'm very skeptical that they do much. The signals in clinical trials are very marginal for most indications. The trials are almost never done the same way twice, so you don't know what's reliable data. The data is a mess. Number of microbes that fit inside a pill seems large if you read the label on the packaging, but it's very, very, very small component of all the stuff that's already in your gut. And experiments show that when you measure what's coming out, you often can't see the probiotic at all. If you do, it's very transient. So it kind of strains credulity to think that they're going to do very much. Maybe for antibiotic-associated diarrhea, you see a signal. That's right. Probably where it's strongest. But that might make sense because you're kind of the disease and the antibiotics, the disorder, are washing out the guts. So maybe there's more opportunity for a probiotic to take residence. But beyond that, it's really not convincing to me.
Carrie, do you have an opinion about all of this?
Yeah, you know, I largely agree with Rick on this. I would say that there are many disorders that have been associated with some type of very, very modest benefit, taking current generation probiotics, but none of them really meets that bar where we really are strong believers that there is a significant effect. Having said that, though, since a lot of these studies, when you line them up, show a trend towards an improvement or some type of benefit, we do hope that eventually that the newer generation of probiotics, using our knowledge that we have gained over the past several years, will allow us to generate the next generation of probiotics that might have more substantial benefits than what we actually see currently with the products that are out there.
Go ahead, Rick.
In general, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of engineering communities that could live in people and improve health or mitigate disease. I think that's extremely promising. It's just that the stuff you buy in the supermarket today really doesn't do much, and there's the risk of confusing consumers for that reason.
Tracy, are there sex differences when it comes to our microbiome, or even as people age, does that change?
There are enormous sex and gender differences. We see this both in rodent models and in humans, the diversity, the complexity of the microbiome, and most definitely across developmental windows. So you see sex specificity and developmental specificity. So the neonate microbiota, which is, of course, when you're nursing, you're taking in predominantly milk, of course, and so you have a high abundance of lactobacillus that's necessary and present, and that complexity and diversity of your gut will change as you age. There's a huge interaction with puberty. So as girls start to cycle with estrogen and boys start to rise testosterone, there's an enormous interaction of your gonadal hormones with your gut microbiota that can have a big impact. And then again, as you go through adulthood and then into aging, your microbiota can change again. And if you do sort of a time course of this, of these changes across in humans and in rodent models, you see lots of interaction both with your age and with what's going on in your endocrine system, hormone responses.
Gary, I was curious about gluten sensitivity. I mean, that seems to be almost the rage now. You go to the supermarket and everything is like gluten-free. Is that part of this conversation?
You know, there are investigators that are very interested in the microbiome and celiac sprue, which is an immunologic disorder to gluten. And I think that it's really early days. We don't know how much of the microbiota actually plays in the role in pathogenesis of that particular disease, because we actually know quite a bit about the immune imbalance that actually occurs and is primarily genetically determined. So that's celiac sprue. Now, that's a very well-defined biochemical and immunologic abnormality. Gluten sensitivity is a much more gray area. Just because individuals who have a genetic predisposition or develop celiac sprue cannot tolerate gluten, that doesn't necessarily mean that gluten is bad for everybody. And so this gluten sensitivity thing, I think, is a very gray area, and there's a lot more clinical work that needs to be done to try to define that entity.
I do want to get to our callers, but I'm also looking at some body. Tracy, looks like you want to add something.
No, I just think what Gary said is very true, and something that consumers need to be very aware of, this idea that the next wave of whether it's probiotics or gluten-free, if there's not really an underlying health reason to be consuming gluten-free, I think it's just the latest wave of people's fixation.
Rick, do you have any thoughts? No. Okay. Let me get – it looks like Jim calling us from Wilmington, Delaware. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. This may be a reach to possibly connect some dots, but I grew up – I was born in 1950 and grew up with a pretty typically dirty childhood for the time. But I was subject to really bad ear infections and earaches, and I was not breastfed, and my father smoked Camel regulars like a chimney, and then I heard that story of several years ago now, I guess, about the correlation between not being breastfed and the cigarette smoke filled atmosphere and having these ear infections. And so it just, while I was listening, it made me think, well, gee, I wonder if, some of that, like less than ideal microbiome stuff would have an effect on fighting off these, infections.
Well, Jim, I'm actually looking at you, Gary. I mean, are we at the point where we can diagnose Jim's ear infections? I mean, certainly not on the radio, but...
Yeah, so I think that, again, these are associations. All the things that you mentioned, Jim, the use of antibiotics and allergies and smoke and things like that are things, environment, that are associated with the development of disease. But we're not at a level right now where we can implicate a specific microbe or class of microbes that we could identify in a laboratory to say, aha, that's actually the cause of your disease. It's very, as I said, it's very early days now. We scientists are working very hard using the types of technologies that Rick talked about to mine the microbiota, to identify organisms that would allow us to predict or diagnose disease. But the field hasn't pulled out things that are definitely actionable, that can be reduced to practice right now. We're hopeful that we will get there, but I think it's too early to say right now.
We have an email from Thomas who says, can your guest comment on the use of fecal transplants for treatment of inflammatory bowel disease? Rick, can you speak to that?
Well, fecal transplants have been used with tremendous success to treat a specific condition, relapsing Clostridia difficile infection.
What is that?
So if you're taking a lot of antibiotics, if you're in the hospital, your gut can be colonized by a very nasty customer called Clostridia difficile.
C. diff.
It makes a very nasty toxin, and it can often be fatal in the elderly. So very bad. Bombing the organism with antibiotics sometimes helps, but what seems to work really well is recolonizing these people with feces from a healthy adult.
Wow.
And it's like 95% curative in trials, just really works well. So really an astounding medical success in recent years. And one of the sort of poster children for the fact that this business about communities of bugs that live associated with your bodies really does matter. So that success has led people to wonder, could this be useful in other kinds of indications? So there are a number of groups trying to treat ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, other diseases with fecal microbial transplants, and others as well. So I think the jury's still out. There might be a little bit of success in some of these inflammatory bowel diseases, but it's not been the same home run as in refractory C. diff infection.
Interesting. Yeah, Gary?
So I would like to add to Rick's comments. Just because fecal microbiota transplantation works in an infectious disease process doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work in other types of diseases. And as Rick mentioned, there are a lot of clinical studies, especially in inflammatory bowel disease, where people are looking at that modality of treatment. I mean, I think I agree with Rick that the results are now fairly equivocal. There are two placebo-controlled trials that have just been completed and reported, one showing a benefit, one not showing a benefit. Mm-hmm. I guess my only comment is that if you're going to be using fecal transplantation for anything other than recurrent Clostridial difficile infection, you should be doing this within the setting of a clinical study, because we don't have any evidence that fecal microbiota transplantation is effective in any other disease other than recurrent Clostridial difficile infection. Mm-hmm. And actually, the FDA mandates that you have to have an IND application approval for use of fecal transplantation for anything other than recurrent Clostridial difficile infection.
Interesting. Let me get Gail from, looks like Ocean City, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gail. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty. Hi. I have some questions. I've had a lousy immune system prior to birth. My mom was given the synthetic hormone drug DES, diethylsilobestrol, which later created understanding, I think it was University of Penn, the offspring of the mothers had risk for cancer. I have a question because I'm wondering about these synthetic hormones and these chemicals that are in our environment every day. I'm talking about cleaning products and things like that that are known neurotoxins, endocrine disruptors, respiratory irritants. I saw that you spoke a little bit about the smoke, salts of the smoke, all the parents smoking in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. I grew up in one of those smoke-filled homes and had about 3 weeks loss of school every year.
Well, you know what, Gail? Let me just jump in here, only because we've got a lot of people. And you raise a question about DES babies, and I want to address that because I think it's important. And I'm actually going to put that to our guest, Tracy Bale.
Yeah, so these children have been well studied in the increased incidence of both programming of cancer, as well as there's now evidence out there for some of these exposures that happened in the 50s of pharmaceuticals to women who were pregnant, that they may underlie. There's study headed up by a foundation of Jill Escher in California that looks at the incidence and the underlying aspects of autism. That because, again, when your mom is ingesting, so if you're pregnant and you're ingesting X, Y, or Z pharmaceutical, there's a direct exposure of the gestating baby, so somatic programming, right, which means the cells that are developing. But there's also the germ cells of that baby that are present and are very vulnerable during those periods of development. And now the thinking is that even if there wasn't a direct effect on so many aspects of the brain for the baby itself, that the germ cells have then given rise to that next generation, which is where we are now, and seeing this rise in neurodevelopmental disorders, that they may be some epigenetic programming that occurred.
Let me get back to our callers. We have, looks like Henrietta calling us from Reading. Henrietta, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to not go back to the yogurt question, but to the traditional foods that have been fermented for centuries in many, many of the traditional cultures. And they contain or are developing a microbiome that is compatible with the people who live in that region because it comes from the same materials that they are, that they live themselves, the air, the water, the ground, and, of course, with that, the produce, be that sauerkraut or kimchi or miso or whatever it may be. That's one aspect. The other thing is that what we're not talking about at all here is looking at it from the prebiotic aspect. What kind of a terrain does the microbiome need to actually develop a healthy thing, a healthy basis? And so that would be fiber. It would be substances such as aloe gel. It would be all sorts of natural substances that would create the basis for the growth. And I can take
sure.
your
thanks, Henrietta.
Answer off the air. You're
sure.
welcome. Thank you, Marty.
You were slightly nodding your head there, Gary Wu, she was talking. Go ahead.
So I think that there are a very strong environmental influences on the development of the microbiota. And, you know, we have evidence that perhaps the big difference between the microbiota and people, for example, living in agrarian cultures in Africa versus, let's say, in the United States, are not primarily driven by diet. It could be an environmental effect, just being born in that environment. So I'll give you one example of this. This was a fascinating paper that was published a couple of years ago, that the Japanese actually have a bacterial taxon, a bacterium that is very good in digesting seaweed algae. And the reason that this bacteria actually has that ability is that there has been gene transfer between organisms, marine organisms that live in the world's oceans, into that bacteria in the gut of people that live in Japan. Well, that organism only lives in the gut of individuals in Japan. They don't actually find it in individuals living in the United States. So that means that growing up and living in Japan, where you're eating much more seaweed-based products, has now engrafted a certain capability of your microbiome that you actually don't see in another type of culture. So there are probably culturally distinct compositions and functions of the microbiota that are independent of diet, that maybe it's just because you're born and you're living in that environment.
That's interesting.
In terms of the prebiotic thing, you know, I actually like the notion of prebiotics. It's not only the ability of prebiotics to change the composition of the microbiota, but the prebiotics are those substances that are delivered to the microbiota that then allow the microbiota to then produce a lot of these metabolites, a lot of these small molecules that Tracy's been talking about that we absorb and that may play a role in mentation and neurofunction. So it's probably matching the prebiotics, the substrate, along with the right types of microbes that are the factories to produce these metabolites that may be the wave of the future.
And it looks like you want to say something.
I just
like
wanted
12
to add exactly
seconds.
What the caller mentioned with the fermentation and fiber processes, which is really necessary very early in development for these short-chain fatty acids to be produced, which are so important for brain development.
So a big cheer for fermentation?
Yeah.
Rah. Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about and digest, if I can use that word. Gary Wu is a professor in gastroenterology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, co-director of the PennCHOP Microbiome Program. Thank you for joining us. Tracy Bale, professor of neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Veterinary Medicine, also in psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Marty.
And Rick Bushman is chair of the microbiology department at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us for today's edition of Radio Times.